You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and we are in the middle of Lent. Today is the 13th of April, 2022. You know, one weakness that I have is I struggle with administration and bureaucracy, what we call policies and procedures. I was never very good with that sort of thing. I was very impatient with it. And you think of the technicalities of the American tax code to the point where it's absurd that the IRS can get you for anything they want, especially if you make enough money. Well, I was supposed to get about a $2,000 tax refund, and that went down to zero because apparently I owed a few years ago. I have no idea what they're talking about. I don't even remember. But, you know, they could pretty much say whatever they want. No one who's rational is going to want to take on the IRS. And you better have an army of lawyers behind you. It took, you know, Microsoft back in the 90s, if you remember. They went to the mattresses then with the Justice Department, and Microsoft went at each other for years, until the federal government simply surrendered. And I realized back then it was a watershed moment for me, because I realized just who held the power, that Microsoft had 10 times the legal power, the number of lawyers, the quality they could pay them whenever they want, versus that little piece of the Justice Department that was going after monopolists. Now, of course, the IRS is under the Treasury, but it really is it's the same. It's the very same principle. And it's just the frustration of living, in a regime dedicated to, not only, you know, our personal destruction and the destruction, it seems, of anything rational. And I start off this way because I want to talk about something that might be considered the very opposite of that kind of nonsense. And it really is nonsense. Medievals never had to worry about this kind of thing. They didn't have to worry about a lot. I want to talk about, since we are in the middle of Lent, we have a couple of weeks before Easter yet. Now, the Westerners are going to be celebrating it. Well, the Westerners celebrate Easter. We celebrate Pascha. And it's actually, I think it's this Sunday. We are, at least this year, it's very the very end of the month. And one of the great aspects of Lent is that we get to revisit the idea of a rational asceticism. Asceticism essentially meaning self-denial. And what I want to say is, and what's important to me, the way I define this, is that since our rational faculty is constantly under assault from everything around us, all the passions that get deliberately provoked by the regime for profit, whether it be over sex or over money or over reputation or anger, to the point where the regime is not in any way rational. It depends on manipulating and harming, using the passions for their own benefit. E. Michael Jones has made, you know, several books on this topic, and it leads to not only a mentally ill and severely alienated group of people, the population, but also one that has long since forgotten how to use their rational faculty. I found, this is a couple of months ago, and I want to bring this up because it is related to this. The website Chateau Hartis, however you say it, I don't know how to say it, I don't care, Batista has a list of academic articles, some of which I've come across, many of them I have not. And it lays out the mainstream, and this is not how they write it or how they state it, but mainstream academia's admission that ideas of diversity are nonsense, not only that, that lead to destruction. You have one here, and I did see this. This came out in 2015, in the European Sociological Review, and it's entitled, "Does Ethnic Diversity Have a Negative Effect on Attitudes Towards the Community? A Longitudinal Analysis of the Causal Claims Within the Ethnic Diversity and Social Cohesion Debate." Actually came out in 16. It was submitted in, or published in 15. Came out in the volume 32, 2016 issue. And they come right out and say it. Now, often they'll use deliberately technical language, but they come out and say that studies demonstrate, not just their own, a negative association between community ethnic diversity and, on the other hand, indicators of social cohesion, especially attitudes towards neighbors and the community as such. Suggesting, and this is them writing here, suggesting that diversity causes a decline in social cohesion. Now, can you imagine having to explain that to somebody, that these academics think that this is a great breakthrough, that when you throw people together who have nothing in common, they're not even speaking the same language, some of them, in our case, non-whites, being told to hate us, and that that has something to do with social cohesion. The fact that you have to explain something like this, and of course they try to cover it up. They say that, oh, well, the evidence for this is based only on cross-sectional research. And of course they fixed that in this article, the author with James Lawrence and Lee Bentley. Another, and this I had not come across, this is in Social Psychology Quarterly, so it's kind of buried here. And this came out in the same year. Effects of heterogeneity in homophily in cooperation. That's H-O-M-O-P-H-I-L-Y. And it's a very similar argument. They talk about microbehavioral models to understand the effect of heterogeneity in social identities on cooperation. And they use a lot of technical language. But ultimately, it comes down to the fact that wherever you have diversity, this hampers between-group cooperation. Again, it seems bizarre that we even have to explain this to anybody, that diversity hampers cooperation at every level. And, in fact, this is getting worse and worse and worse. The author there is Ozan Uxley. Here's another. This comes from Rebecca Wicks and a few other authors. This is in the Journal of All Things, Journal of Urban Affairs, and this came out in 13. And it references Putnam, who was very famous for talking about the decline in social institutions leading to the decline of general social trust. You know, his book is called Bowling Alone, among others. We all had to read this in grad school, which says things like bowling leagues and PTA and these, you know, the YMCA, these non-political institutions are essential in building trust. But Putnam also stated that ethnic diversity is a huge challenge for developing and sustaining any kind of social capital. Now again, Putnam, being a mainstream academic, argues clearly diversity decreases social cohesion and reduces social interactions among community residents. And they admit, they say there is not much done in academia on how this kind of diversity impacts social cohesion and neighborly exchange behaviors. They go, now she's referring to Australia, but it doesn't make any difference. And diversity means a whole lot of things. Now, she's talking about the suburbs of Brisbane, and it's clear that diversity lowers social cohesion, and something I've never heard of before, something called hunkering. And this is a huge problem. And everything, you know, these analysis, paper after paper, violence even between groups can be inhibited through the creation of borders. And this goes back. This goes on and on and on. Even to the point where you have immigration. That is, you know, immigration from a group very different from the host group undermines the moral imperative of those who most favor welfare benefits for the neediest. Again, this shouldn't be all that shocking. And this is from that particular line is from the International Journal of Comparative Sociology that came out in 2012, written by Tim Rieskens. And they call this the Age of Migration. And it's called, further, the New Liberal Dilemma. Trying to find popular support for welfare programs that at one point were installed in times of the rule of a homogenous society. But then, when that's no longer homogenous, where is the support for welfare policies? And the fact is that they break down. And they're using the European Social Survey from 2008, that when the people that are going to be affected by social welfare programs of all types, financed by taxpayers, are not like you and may even be hostile to you. And I think this one came out of Denmark, the Netherlands as well, that part of the world, that people withdraw. They have no problem in supporting this stuff if it's their own people, if it's their own ethnic family. But the minute you have people who are hostile to you or very different from you or don't have the same point of view as you, ethnically speaking, it goes away. And I could go on and on. There's about 20 of these listed here. And again, they disguise their finding. And they do that by using overly technical language. They second-guess themselves. And all the rest. Now, I bring this up for a few reasons. And one of the most important is that being a part of the national collective is, in fact, an aesthetic labor. In fact, family life is an aesthetic labor. All of this is limiting your desires for the sake of allowing your reason to function. And I started off talking about the attacks on our reason from all these passionate drives that the regime deliberately provokes. But aestheticism limits or eliminates those, and what takes its place is reason. Now, of course, in the Old Testament, when the Israelites began to worship the idols that really represent class rule and commerce, the gods that the regime worships today, what did God do? God condemned them. He did everything he could. He sent prophets. They killed them. And as a last resort, God raised up the empires of Babylon and Persia to destroy it. And the prophets are very clear. Free trade, individualism, or some variant, oligarchy, and a very crude universalism, you know, that we're all the same kind of nonsense, caused God to destroy Israel. Now, whether God destroys a country directly through his own direct command, or it lets nature take its course and destroy itself, is really irrelevant. What we're seeing in those academic articles, and I could keep going, I could cite, you know, a few dozen more just right here. It's auto-destruction. It's destruction from within. Natural law being what it is, sin contains its own punishment. Because ethnic diversity is part of an ideological crusade against us. It's about low wages. It's about destroying social cohesion. So the only thing left is corporations and consumption. And low wages leading and really finding its apex in the so-called Great Reset, where private property is taken away in exchange for debt reduction, which is really what that is. So what did the prophets say? The prophets came into this and said the ascetic life is to be found in the loyalty to the nation, specifically to race, and using genetic terms, you know, at the time, and the faith that it all, that God has revealed to them. And the prophet said this is a way to not only rebuild social health and legitimate equality, especially within extended family, which is commanded by the book of Leviticus, and of course to avoid destruction, whether it be your own internal disintegration or God's specific command to destroy you. Now, part of the problem, and I've said this before, is that a word like nationalism, and I call myself a nationalist, social nationalist, whatever you want to say, people define that term however they please. They say stupid things like, well, I'm not a nationalist, but I'm a patriot. And they make some very arbitrary distinction between the two. Well, they shouldn't be using these words at all, because these terms are very specific. Nationalism connects to the ethnic group, which itself connects to the extended family. And not only does both testaments of the Bible, but the church fathers were very clear about this. Many of you know Acts 17:26. God hath made of one blood all nations of men, for to dwell on all the face of the earth, and has determined the times before appointed, the bounds of their habitation. That's the most blatant, kind of in-your-face citation, that not only are nations real, but God has created them. David Carlton, who I've cited on this show before, a good writer, and he wrote something, he's not Orthodox, but I recommend, an article called A Biblical Defense of Ethno-Nationalism. He said, the Bible places familial authority in the hands of husbands and fathers. This is considered sexist or chauvinistic by today's standard, but God does not answer to man's opinions. In the Bible, the civic authority is a natural outgrowth of familial authority. The foundational text for this position is in Deuteronomy 17:15, which states that Israel should set one from among their brethren to be king over them, and that they were not to put a stranger over them who was not their brother. Now, it's important also to keep in mind that brothers, as a term, does not always refer to Christians in the Bible. Numbers 20, Deuteronomy 1:16, and even 23, 2 Kings 10, Nehemiah 5, Jeremiah 34:9, Romans 9, are examples of it being used in the ethnic sense in terms of Israel's identity. This is an ethnic reference. Now, of course, faith is central, but there wasn't this gulf between the ethnic group and the faith. In fact, ethnic groups are successful. In other words, they thrive and remain independent because they have a single faith that animates them. So what it comes down to is that Orthodox men today, they either abandon the Old Testament, which many have already done, or finally accept the idea that not only is nationalism defined properly acceptable, but even to reject it is sinful, maybe even a heresy. We are not permitted a multitude of opinions. That's the whole point of the Old Testament. There is one view, that of the law of nature. And this is one of the main reasons the Old Testament is included in Scripture at all. And I have predicted this for several years. I will say it again. The next stupid trend in the church is going to be a movement to decanonize the Old Testament. Maybe they'll leave the Psalms, but they will purge their meaning, several of them, which are very harsh, in things that we agree with. They will purge even those. Now, there's one reason that that might not happen, and that is only because people are so obtuse they couldn't read and understand the Old Testament if there was a pistol at their head. It's extremely difficult. It is not an easy book to read. Let me continue. Carlton continues in that article. He says, Isaiah 56 is a good example of strangers or foreigners joining God's covenant. Samuel Rutherford uses Deuteronomy 17 as a foundational text of his classic magnum opus on civil government, in which he comments, quote, the king is a relative, unquote. I would also point out that strangers could be circumcised. but we're still reckoned apart from the children of Israel, and we're not made civil magistrate. The nation of Israel was based on heredity. Leviticus 18:26 is particularly informative, because those who keep God's law and statutes are said to be of the Israelite nation, that is to say, the ethno, and strangers and Israelites that dwell among them. This is a solid example of how the nation of Israel was considered to be hereditary, not solely covenantal or spiritual. The argument that I've made many times, the civil power ruling from and over the nation is part of God's creation. It is not a conventional matter. It's not a matter of convention, it's a matter of natural law. Now, I don't want to say that the civil power then is identical to the modern state today. That's nonsense. The modern state couldn't possibly, the Leviathan that Hobbes advocated, which is the reality today, could not even have been conceived at the time. The closest we get is probably the Book of Daniel. However, you do have amateur historians usually can't make these fine distinctions. The state, constitution, civil power, the crown, society, these are all different but of course related and overlapping things. Some people try to shut down the discussion by saying, well, Christians aren't supposed to be political. And of course, that's another word they refuse to define. Justice is the issue here. Justice is not a political issue if politics is defined as mere campaigns and elections. Those are vulgar. Nationalism deals exclusively with peoples and the nature of communal standards. It doesn't have an immediate connection to a state or a government, but it's clearly related to them. The Bible and the church fathers treat society as a family, an extended family. The civil power comes out of the extended family, and because of that is automatically part of God's creation and therefore natural law. And he notes that 2 Samuel 5 and 1 Chronicles 11, the claim to legitimacy, any kind of moral legitimacy of any government, is based on ethnic and clearly genetic foundations. It says, and this is 2 Samuel 19, you are my brethren, you are my bone and my flesh. Why then are you the last to bring back the king and say to Amasa, are you not my bone and my flesh? Now, that's not only the foundation for nationalism, but it is a clearly, not only is the foundation, it's one of the more important ones, scripturally speaking. And Carlton and many others, such as myself, they point out that the nature of political rule is not unlike that of marriage. Even the flesh and bone metaphor is used in the marriage ceremony as well, the wedding ceremony. Ethnic groups, which I use as identical to nations, these are creations of God and exist at the same moral level as the family does. And they should be maintained in their purity no differently than the individual personality, or the family should be maintained that way. You know, I cited those articles, and it's shocking, because I came out of the academic world, that was just a part of my day-to-day life. It's bizarre now, as I've gotten older, to say the most obvious things. And this is something along the lines of wondering why, let's say you have a family, you live in a home, and the state decrees that these fourth worlders are going to invade your house and live with you. They're going to live with you, they're going to sleep in your bed, and they're going to... And then they say, oh my God, this has really had a negative impact on how this family functions, of how it views the world, how they view each other. They don't trust anybody now. How crazy is that? That's essentially what this amounts to. And this is what happens when political rule is as much psychological as it is legal. But it was really right after the Second World War where these things were challenged for the first time. Let me continue with Carlton's work, which again, I strongly recommend. And one of these things, when you read him, of course. But then you realize, wait a minute, I just said something that could get me fired of saying something so clear. He says, civil consideration also prevented marriage with people who were Israel's enemy. The law, Deuteronomy 23, especially 1-8, was applied by Ezra and Nehemiah to prevent marriage to those who would seek Israel's harm. The practical reason for this rule in Deuteronomy 17 is obvious. If a stranger governs a nation, then he will naturally expropriate the wealth and property of the native people for the benefit of those who are of his own bone and flesh. This applies both to Christians as well as non-Christians, since multiple nations will always exist within the church, even in heaven. There can be no exceptions to this rule. God temporarily used Joseph as a wise regent to Pharaoh in Egypt, and King Cyrus' righteous decree allowed the Israelites to return to their homeland under his protection. Now, their exceptions to the rule are a clear case of God bringing the best out of a less than ideal situation. This is extremely well put. When the Holy Spirit descended on Pentecost, how many languages were heard? The number was as many as there were people present from different nations. You see, if universalism was the goal, then only one language would have been spoken, and the people would have been miraculously granted the ability to understand it. That's not what happened. The concept of multinational is healthy because it implies nations that exist in cooperation. Its opposite is cosmopolitanism. That is not healthy. It is based on alienation and impending spiritual death. If you extinguish culture, you extinguish humanity. This is why the Orthodox Church has ethnic churches and has always had ethnic churches. It's based on the fairly obvious point of view that civic life needs to take place in an ethnic context. One language, one faith, one code of laws. Otherwise, you have chaos. You have expropriation. You have using one group against another. And if it's done deliberately, as Stalin did, as happened in many empires, the point is to have enemies at each other's throats so they are wasting their resources on that. And they cannot prosper. And the prophet said the exact same thing, going so far as saying that the economic foundation for each family should be basically equal to the founding extended families of Israel. And it was done every 50 years at the Jubilee, where all debts were canceled. That's Leviticus 25. It's amazing how these Bible-believing Christians refuse to talk about that. These people who are obsessed with the canons don't bring this up ever. Oligarchy and imperialism are hand in hand and are equally condemned. But even before the prophets, we read Leviticus is before the prophets, so is Deuteronomy. And it says clearly, chapter 17, you shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses. One from among your brethren you shall set as king over you. You may not set a foreigner over you who is not your brother. And as far as the church fathers, from the treatises of Cyprian, this is page 1012, he says, it is a source of joy and glory to men to have children like unto themselves, and it is more agreeable to have begotten an offspring than when the remaining progeny responds to the parent with like lineaments. How much greater is the gladness of God the Father when anyone is so spiritually born that in his acts and praises a divine eminence of grace, of race, that is to say, genus, is announced. There's an explicit mention of race here. St. Jerome, he says, the Apostle Paul says in Romans 9, 3, 4, I could wish that I myself were anathema from Christ for my brethren's sake, my kinsmen according to the flesh, who are Israelites. Moreover, they are called brethren by kindred, who are of one family, the patria, which corresponds to the Latin paternitas, because from a single root, a numerous progeny proceeds. That's from Against Helvidius, paragraph 16. And in all these cases, it's one and the same. The nation is seen as the literal extension of the family, not genetically related or over a long period of time with many people, but they are kinsmen and they are brethren because they are from the same nation, and nations are based on faith. These things can't be easily separated. Those not in the service of this are responsible for what happens when it's neglected. Now, I remember writing against, you know, some of the mainline Orthodox people, and I said, you know, I know what's going to happen here. When I responded to their criticism of what they called racism, you know, it's very vague, and I said, no, none of you guys are going to challenge me in terms of actual substance. You're going to attack me personally. I say it right in there. And, of course, that's exactly what they do. And many of them if not all of them, have never heard of these things before. And certainly have never considered them before. Because I doubt there's anyone in their lives who thinks about this. St. John of Kronstadt, who blessed the banner of the Black Hundreds, or the Union of the Russian People, who does speak for the church in this respect, and he says, now he's talking about Russians specifically, just very close to the revolution, he says, what would you be without a czar of Russians? Your enemies would try to destroy even the very name of Russia. For the guardian and protector of Russia after God is God, Russia's sovereign, the real czar, and without him, Russia is not Russia. Our current restless and unacknowledged politicians desire a constitution or republican form of rule in Russia, but they do not understand the history and character of the Russian people, who cannot be without a czar, who live only by him, and who, after God and the heavenly queen, place their hopes in him alone. Thus let us venerate the czar as a ruler given by God for the good of Russia. Now, I've cited sources in the Old Testament that refer to a monarch, that a monarch will be appointed. He'll be appointed by God, but then say that he must not be a foreigner. Again, these are very obvious, ordinary concepts prior to the advent of institutionalized liberalism after the war. The alliance between Marxism and liberalism that exists to this very day. Although, as you know, I've said for a long time, Michael Jones, the working class, not only that's never had anything to do with Marxism, at least in the 20th and 21st century, that's been abandoned. It had nothing to do with anything in the Soviet Union, and has nothing to do with it now. Now, of course, they've altered it through people like Foucault and others to concern sexual, gender, and racial groups who they mobilized deliberately as the so-called new proletariat. Now, because it is Lent, and his feast day, his feast day was yesterday, and he's also specifically commemorated in the fourth Sunday of Lent, I wanted to talk briefly about St. John of the Ladder. St. John of the Ladder, St. John Climacus, came as close as anyone could come in creating a handbook for what the ascetic life is. If you remember a few years ago, I did a two or three part series on the saints of Montenegro and its national tradition. And I don't think there's any other nation on this planet, Montenegrins are Serbs, but there is no other nation, you can include the Serbs here too, no other nation on this planet who's been more vehemently ethno-nationalist than they have. And it makes sense, as I've said before, that because they were under the occupation, especially Serbia, maybe not Montenegro as such, but they were under a violent occupation of the Turkish and therefore Judaic empire for several hundred years, and were, as always, massively depopulated. Montenegro, because it was so small and so mountainous, as the name suggests, it was very difficult to subdue them. And in fact, they never were fully subdued, except by modernism, by modernity. But prior to that, the ferocity of the Orthodox Church relative to those who wanted to destroy the nation and hence the Church, as one and the same thing, was the very core of their saints, royal and otherwise, the consensus of the Montenegrin choir. They are an extraordinary people. They're a heroic people. And if you go back, it's 2 years ago. I believe it was May, 2 years ago, 2020. I dealt with the idea, the core idea, that the ascetic life is similar. It has a different end, but the ascetic life of the soldier in the battlefield and the monk in the monastery or the hermitage, they both are at war with the vices and the passions. A soldier has to overcome his desire to flee. He has to overcome his fear of death or being harmed badly. And what drives him forward is the idea that if he fails, what's going to happen to the people at home? What motivates this man? He has parents, he has wife, he has young children. What are these people going to do if I fail? And that drives him forward. And that is sufficient, in many cases, to merit salvation, if done for the Christian life, and done within an Orthodox context. This is why the Kosovo, I'm looking right now at a beautiful icon of the Kosovo martyrs, and it just so happens that they're on a ladder going from the battlefield to the heaven. And now we're talking about St. John of the Ladder, St. John Climacus, we get the word climb from it, using the exact same metaphor. These 30 steps, in his case, of how to get to a life mired like pigs in sin and the passions that could never, ever be satisfied, to a state of relative purity. Now, of course, we all know, just like we're talking about two realms, physical and spiritual, external or internal, really, I should say. We're also talking about two forms of life, the phenomenal and the noumenal. Now, when I say noumenal, I'm not making a direct reference to Kant. It's just it's a word that makes sense here. The word of our interior nature, our mind, our belief system, how cohesive it is, how correct it is, and how that's manifest day to day in the phenomenal world. There's a very good reason why intentions mean a lot in Orthodox theology. We aren't really responsible. I mean, if we do something that has great merit and it ends up blowing up in our faces, no good deed goes unpunished, that's not our fault. That aspect of it is really, unless we know for a fact it's going to happen, that cannot be laid at our feet. We give money to the poor and the homeless. I don't care what they do with it. That's not my problem. Of course, unless I know for absolutely certain he's going to do something terrible with it. Without that knowledge, we are obligated to give. And once we give, that is out of our hands. So what we have in the internal realm, the noumenal realm, our belief system, which can be perfect, it can be pure, if our intentions are, of course, can never be pure and is laden with sin once it's projected into the phenomenal world, the world of causality, the world of the day-to-day. And that gets worse, and that this gulf becomes greater when a virtuous man is placed in a sick society. I think I said last week to read Dostoevsky's The Idiot. This is exactly on this topic. What happens? Of course, this is the scriptural story. What happens when you put the God-man, a perfect man, who has deliberately limited himself, into a sick society? And that's, of course, what Christ did. Christ, who was the God, creator of all things, made himself a homeless wanderer, worse off than us on the social scale, to be tormented and beaten and insulted day to day until, of course, finally, a week after Palm Sunday, to be tortured to death temporarily. We get angry when someone below us gets all uppity, someone who's ignorant attacks us about something. Can you imagine how intense that would be if you were the God and creator of all things? I do want to note, of course, that the ladder itself, it's written in terms of steps, but these steps are always intertwined with each other. Don't get the impression that if you master step two, okay, that's done, I now can go to step three. That's not how this works. This isn't really a matter of causality. This is just a convenient way of organizing our attempt to rid ourselves of the sickness of this world. And of course, the term world is a very specific one. The term world has many definitions, but the one we're using here is a negative one. The world is this arena of anger, of the passions, of violence, of crime, of lies. The worst that the phenomenal world has to offer. Which is why the very first step is renunciation. It's not to say that you withdraw yourself from good deeds or justice or anything like that. That's not what it means. That you drop all of these drives, whether it be, you know, this is for monks, but for sexuality, for greed, for good reputation. You hide yourself away from this. You realize that none of that stuff can ever really work out in the end. And that, of course, leads to detachment, some variation of temperance. Now, for a monk, it's much easier in that respect than for a married man, someone who lives in the world. But you can renounce the regime without simply, you know, refusing to work. Of course, we all have to do that. One has nothing to do with the other. And the third is obedience. When you empty yourself of these drives, you place yourself not just in obedience to the church itself and its doctrine, but also to your spiritual father, whoever that might be, someone experienced. And you give yourself over to him. Again, monastic life, it's much more straightforward. That should not be used as an excuse not to do anything, but obedience is extremely difficult. When you're proud, like me, it's hard to listen. And that's, you know, nothing new to for a lot of people. That, of course, leads to exile. Now, don't misrepresent this. I spent a lot of time talking about nationalism. The show is named after it. My life is dedicated to it. The Orthodox Christian the Russian Orthodox national idea. Orthodox Christian is a misnomer. That phrase doesn't. But exile is the notion that struggle is going to be our life. This is a lifelong pilgrimage and struggle. It's a separation from sin and passion. Instead, it's dedicated to duty, and duty is based on love. The basic notion of penitence, is based also on everything that's come before here. And that itself leads to the remembrance of death. This is something I don't think I've ever mentioned here. It seems that modern society is based on throwing constant distractions in front of us. That's supposed to calm our anxieties and not have us consider that the culture of youth doesn't mean much. I just turned 50 last year. Many of you are roughly my age. And if you're 20 listening to this, you're going to be in my position very, very soon. A lot sooner than you think. The great Seraphim Rose, one of his great slogans, and one I have a similar one, is, it's later than you think. Mine always was, it's worse than you think. And all of this, within these virtues, is that of perseverance. Remembrance of death, and the fact that I grew up in a funeral home, is not irrelevant. I grew up with death everywhere. I was not shielded from it. And I remember, even as a kid, there was these, in the cemeteries I went to, you saw some of these people who died in the 20s, in the 30s, and some of them even had pictures attached to the headstone in their old clothing and everything else. I remember thinking, and I do, I'm not saying this now. I said it at the time, that everything that they were worried about, everything that motivated them, their desire for money and a promotion, is laughably irrelevant today. It is gone. In 1992, a friend of the family blew his brains out. The most irrational thing you can do. Because depression projects a distorted world, a world that does not exist. That was in 92. I remember that funeral. Now, if he didn't do that, all the stuff that led to him killing himself would be gone. It would be irrelevant. It would be a distant memory. How long ago was that? But things seem so vivid in the moment. And there's no coming back from that. But the remembrance of death means that all the stuff, and it's a weapon against the passions, all the stuff that seems so vivid to us in the moment, in a very short time is going to be totally and laughably irrelevant. All the things that our ancestors worried about are gone. And that's what struck me about that suicide. 1992, in the summertime, that everything that tortured him at the time, I didn't know, my parents knew him, but everything that tortured him at the time would be a distant, he probably wouldn't even remember it today in 2022, all these years later. And that leads, of course, to a legitimate sorrow. Sorrow is not depression. Depression is a delusion that paints the world, you know, in the most ridiculously negative colors. It's a delusion. It's a form of most mental illnesses, delusion. Now, sorrow is the understanding that everything around us very soon is not going to be there. Things that motivate the passions. When we are slighted and we get angry, that slight is going to be forgotten probably in a week or two, or years at the worst. And yet we lash out on someone and risk hurting someone. We risk going to prison. You know, New Jersey and parts of Northern Virginia were like that. I'm living in a part of the world where that's not as, on the road and in public is not as prevalent. But anger will destroy you. It will eat you from the inside out. St. John talks about forgiveness, to forgive very quickly, to remember all the times when you did stupid things. 99% of the debates that I'm involved with now are really not worth getting into, because these are people who have no intention of listening. They have no intention of putting the pieces together, as many of you have done. They have no intention of this. Falsehood. Falsehood is the creation of an illusion. It's a creation of an illusion. It's the creation of delusion. You lie to somebody, you are painting for them a completely made-up view of the world. Falsehood is the destruction of love. Things like gluttony, lust, and I think men have it slightly worse than women in that department, that this is the cause for constant warfare. We live in an age where it is impossible to get away from these constant invitations. And you're going to fall. There's no doubt about it. And all of that, of course, to some extent, comes from greed. Greed comes from pride. Greed and pride are identical to idolatry. Don't think that the notion of idolatry has to do with a literal idol that you burn incense to. That's not what's meant. That's symbolic of it. Greed, this idea that I deserve something, is not only going to disappear in a very short time, but derives from your own pride. Pride that we all suffer with. Insensitivity. The notion of, sensitivity is really the same as anxiety. And St. John is very clear what insensitivity is. This is in the book Step 18. Insensitivity is a deadened feeling in body and spirit, and comes from long sickness and carelessness. Lack of awareness is negligence that has become habit. It is thought gone numb, an offspring of predisposition, a trap for zeal, a noose for courage, an ignorance of compunction, the gateway to despair, the mother of forgetfulness, giving birth to loss of fear of God, and in turn, to a deadened spirit like a daughter bearing her own mother. The insensitive man is a foolish philosopher, an exegete condemned by his own words, a scholar who contradicts himself, a blind man teaching sight to others. He talks about healing a wound and does not stop making it worse. He complains about what has happened and does not stop eating what is harmful. He prays against it but carries on as before, doing it and being angry with himself. And the wretched man is in no way shamed by his own words. He cries that he's doing wrong and zealously continues to do so. His lips pray against it and his body struggles for it. Insensitivity is a powerful vice to overcome. Even fear. In this case, the notion in step 20, alertness. And he says, some stand weaponless and without armor before the kings of earth, while others hold insignia of office, shields, and swords, the former are vastly superior to the latter, since they are regularly the personal relations of the king and members of the royal household. And, of course, he simply applies that to our standing before God as the king. Alertness keeps the mind clean, as he says. Lessons binds the soul. The alert monk does battle with fornication, but the sleepy one goes to live with it. Alertness is a quenching of lust, deliverance from fantasies and dreams, a tearful eye, a heart made soft and gentle, thoughts restrained, food digested, passions tamed, spirits subdued, tongue controlled, idle imaginings banished. The next one, 21, is on unmanly fears. And he says, if you pursue virtue in a monastery or in gatherings of holy men, you are unlikely to be attacked by cowardice. But if you pass your time in solitary abodes, you must strive not to be mastered by cowardice, the child of vainglory, the daughter of unbelief. Cowardice is childish behavior within a soul advanced in years and vainglory. It is a lapse from faith that comes from anticipating the unexpected. Fear is danger, tasted in advance, a quiver as the heart takes fright before unnamed calamity. Fear is a loss of assurance. A proud soul is a slave of cowardice. Trusting only itself, it is frightened by a sound or a shadow. What this comes down to, of course, are two things. Vainglory and, the worst of all, pride. St. John says, pride is a denial of God, an intervention of the devil. It is a contempt for men. It is the mother of condemnation, the offspring of praise, a sign of barrenness. It is a flight from God's help, the harbinger of madness, the author of downfall. It is a cause of diabolical possession, the source of anger, the gateway to hypocrisy. It is a fortress of demons, the custodian of sins, the source of hard-heartedness. It is a denial of compassion, a bitter Pharisee, a cruel judge. It is the foe of God. It is the root of blasphemy. Pride begins where vainglory leaves off. This kind of language we often need to hear. Pride is one of the worst things we can have. The next is on meekness, simplicity, guilelessness, and wickedness. He says, light of dawn comes before the sun, and meekness is the precursor of all humility. Christ says, learn of me, because I am meek and humble of heart, as he says in Matthew. Therefore, before gazing at the sun of humility, we must let the light of meekness flow over us. Meekness is a mind consistent amid honor or dishonor. Meekness prays quietly and sincerely for a neighbor, however troublesome he may be. Meekness is a rock looking out over the sea of anger, which breaks the waves which come crashing on it and stays entirely unmoved. It is a bulwark of patience, the door, indeed the mother of love, and the foundation of discernment. Humility, of course, the opposite of pride. Our theme of pride, he said, of humility, he said, sets before us a touchstone, a treasure stored safely in earthen vessels, that is, our own bodies. This treasure is of a quality that eludes adequate description. It carries an inscription of heavenly origin, which is therefore incomprehensible, so that anyone seeking words for it is faced with a great or endless task. It is holy humility. It is an extraordinary thing. This is, you know, end quote. This is the one of the goals that we have. And is really one of the goals of the Christian life in general. And he says in this respect, he says, some drive out empty pride by thinking to the end of their lives of their past misdeeds, for which they were forgiven and which now serve as a spur to humility. Others, remembering the passion of Christ, think of themselves as eternally in debt. Others hold themselves in contempt when they think of their daily sins. Others come to possess this mother of graces by way of their continuous temptation, weakness, and sin. You know, what it comes down to is that the more we advance in the spiritual life, one of the great signs of this advancement is realizing just how far away from the standard we, in fact, are. And then discernment, or self-knowledge. He says it's midway along the road to perfection, the spiritual capacity to distinguish unfailingly between what is truly good and what is what in nature is opposed to this good. Discernment is an uncorrupted conscience. It is pure perception. This comes from logic. This comes from reason. This comes from a reason unclouded by the passions that are thrown at us every single day. And it's one of the longest of all of the steps that he talks about. Then he mentions stillness. And he says, we are like purchased slaves, like servants under contract to the unholy passions. And because this is so, we know a little of their deceits, their ways, their impositions and wiles. We know their evil despotism and our wretched souls. But there are others who fully understand the tricks of these spirits, and they do so because of the working of the Holy Spirit and because of the freedom they themselves have managed to achieve. Understand ultimately here that virtue is true autonomy. It derives from the concept of the ascetic life in general. And he says, the start of stillness is rejection of all noisiness in the world, he means, as something that will trouble the depths of the soul. The final point is when one has no longer a fear of noisy disturbance. This is something that destroys our inner peace. And on prayer, coming to the end, he says, prayer is a mother and daughter of tears. It is an expiation of sin, a bridge across temptation, a bulwark against affliction. It wipes out conflict. It's the work of angels. Prayer is future gladness, action without end, wellspring of virtue, source of grace, hidden progress, food of the soul, enlightenment of the mind, and acts against despair, hope demonstrated, sorrow done away with. And he says, if you've ever found yourself having to appear before a human judge, God forbid, you may use that as an example of how to conduct yourself in prayer. Perhaps you've never stood in front of a judge nor witnessed a cross-examination. In that case, take your cue from the way patients appeal to surgeons prior to an operation. And in your prayers, there is no need of high-flown words, for it is the simple, unsophisticated babblings of children that have more often won the heart of the Father in heaven. Clearly, this isn't prayer in the sense that we normally consider it. Near the end, step 29, dispassion. Dispassion is an uncompleted perfection of the perfect. If to be furious, even in solitude, is talked of as a sea of wrath, then calmness, whether you are slain to be present or not, will be a sea of long-suffering. Blessed dispassion raises the poor mind from earth to heaven, raises the beggar from the dunghill of passion, and love, all praise to it, makes him sit with princes, that is, holy angels, and with the princes of God's people. Step 30, the end, on faith, hope, and love. He says, after everything that we've said, there remains that triad, faith, hope, and love, binding and securing the union of all. A man who wants to talk about love is undertaking to speak about God, but it is risky to talk about God, and could even be dangerous for the unwary. God is love, we say in 1 John, but someone eager to define this is blindly striving to measure the sand in the ocean. Love by its nature is resemblance to God, insofar as this is humanly possible. In its activity, it is inebriation of the soul. Its distinctive character is to be a fountain of faith, an abyss of patience, a sea of humility. Someone truly in love keeps before his mind's eye the face of the beloved and embraces it there tenderly. Even during sleep, the longing continues unappeased, and he murmurs to his beloved. That's how it is for the body, and that is how it is for the spirit. A man wounded by love had this to say about himself, and it really amazes me. He says, I sleep because nature commands it, but my heart is awake because of the abundance of my love. And that comes from the Song of Songs, chapter 5. You should take note, my brother, that the stag, which is a soul, destroys reptiles and then, inflamed by love, as if struck by an arrow, it longs and grows faint for the love of God, in Psalm 41. You could tell that this kind of language, this sort of rhetoric, and he says, one of my favorite sections, men who have attained this angelic state, that is, love, often forget to eat. And I really think that they don't even miss their food. No wonder, since an opposite desire drives out the very wish to eat. And indeed, I suspect the bodies of those incorruptible men are immune to sickness, for their bodies have been sanctified and rendered incorruptible by the flame of chastity, which has put out the flame. My belief, and this is John talking here, my belief is that they accept without any pleasure the food set in front of them, for just as subterranean waters nourish the roots of a plant, the fires of heaven are there to sustain their souls. The growth of fear is a starting point of love, and total purity is a foundation for theology. This isn't the way that many church fathers speak and write. But this is, as much as humanly possible, laying out of what has to be mastered for us to consider ourselves Christians. None of us, St. John himself, none of us will master these. We can't. It was extremely difficult in the late 7th century where he lived. It certainly is almost impossible for us here in 2022, where the end is very close. And understand the connection. The ideas of nationalism and royalism are based on self-sacrifice. Having power, you know, as our Nicholas always would say, having power is a curse. Even Marcus Aurelius said this. The people who pursue it are the very last people who should have it, because they have this fantasy of what power is. Now, power is crushing responsibility, and that's no different for us as we continue our fights, continue our battles with the regime, and of course, with ourselves. Yes, we talk all the time on this show about the regime and what it is and what we're supposed to do, but it's also time for us to consider what we have to do internally, because we have internalized the regime. I didn't convert till I was in my 20s. That means there were all those years where the regime had free reign. I hated it, but I couldn't understand why. Most people hate it. But they don't understand why, and they don't know how to fix it. And there's no one to teach them. The ascetic life that St. John lays out, whether it be for the monk in the cell, for the married man in the home, or for the soldier on the field, or the politician arguing his case, it is very similar. Just has a different end, has a different set of means. So I hope you listen and take this stuff very seriously. This is what the Christian life is. This is what the Christian life is, whether it be political, economic, familial, or, of course, ultimately, it's all about our souls and limiting our desires for the sake of the greater good. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.